That's how it goes. Here to talk more about it is totally, definitely not an impersonator, but the actual Ron Johnson. Welcome to the show, Senator.
Kristen, it's great to be here with you again. I love that, you know, in your intro that they pronounce your last name, Kristen Bry. You know, because I didn't know how to say it. We call you Kristen Lai, where in my parts in Green Bay and the areas of the Fox Valley. So, it syncs up nicely with that.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time. This is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin. Welcome to the noon hour of As Goes Wisconsin. I am your host, Kristen Bry, here along with Jane Matinere, as always. And I think it was about a month ago that we were talking about trying to get someone on from Clean Wisconsin.
Yes.
Because for more than 50 years, Clean Wisconsin has been working to preserve and protect Wisconsin's clean water, clean air, and natural heritage. And earlier this year, in January, they released a new report that reveals that when it comes to land use, Wisconsin could reap far more energy from solar than just cornfields. And so here to talk about the findings of that report that was aptly titled Corn Ethanol versus Solar Land Use Comparison, and more about Clean Wisconsin in general, is Climate, Energy, and Air Program Director Chelsea Chandler and the Science Program Director Paul Mathewson. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And so, I guess to start with, how much cornfield does Wisconsin actually have?
Total cornfield, I think we're over 4 million acres of total corn.
Wow. So 4 million acres. And that, how does that compare to then how many, but most of that corn, like, it's not just corn in the cob, right? This is not a lot of corn that's just being, needs to be eaten at like the summer, like Wisconsin State Fair before the end of the summer. It's mostly used for ethanol, right?
Well, most of it, the vast majority of it goes to animal feed.
Oh, okay.
Like 3 million acres of it, like 3/4 of it goes to that. A quarter of it goes to ethanol, and very, very little goes, I don't know what the percentage is, but very little goes to corn on the cob that you'll eat on your plate.
Okay. And so, just as a reminder, so a lot of it's for feed, but for ethanol, what is actually, like, what sources of energy does ethanol provide?
Yeah, so ethanol is used to blend with gasoline to power cars and trucks. So there's the United States, they have a renewable fuel standard, federal rule saying certain amount of our car gasoline needs to have renewable fuel in it. And right now that is basically means ethanol from corn. There are other sources of ethanol, but here in the United States, that's the vast majority of the ethanol. So yeah, it's used in to power our cars and trucks.
So it's arguably also considered a clean energy source as far as a alternative for certain cars than gas and oil.
So,
am I getting that wrong?
No. It's a tricky question. But by rule, it needs to have 20% fewer greenhouse gas emissions than gasoline. So,
okay.
And to meet the requirements of this rule, they've done the accounting on corn ethanol, and it, for official accounting purposes, it meets that requirement. That is 20% less greenhouse gas emissions. Of course, there are. That is disputed. Earlier last year, University of Wisconsin researchers, they put out a study showing that if you account for the land use change associated with ethanol production, because by their calculations, this rule has resulted in natural lands being cleared and replaced with corn for ethanol. And so if you account for that, then we've actually increased greenhouse gas emissions due to this rule. But that, you know, it's controversial whether, you know, what you include on it. But by rule, it has to, yes, the idea is that it's a fuel that is more carbon, less carbon intensive than gasoline to make it more more environmentally friendly. So that's the intent of the rule.
Got it. Okay. Go ahead, Chelsea.
And I would just add to, you know, Paul spoke to the carbon footprint of it, but there's also other kind of environmental considerations that we want to think about when we're talking about whether it is sort of a cleaner source. So in addition to sort of the carbon impact, there's also impacts on water quality from runoff of growing that corn, implications to soil health as well. So it's important to look at kind of the full picture too of the environmental impacts.
Absolutely. And we're going to get into that a little bit because before we get into that a little bit further, I want to comparatively how much land currently in Wisconsin is being used for solar panel farms.
Right now, we're on the order of maybe a few thousand acres.
So compared to 4 million.
Compared to 4 million. Okay. So, I mean, we also don't have all that much. You know, it's a growing source of energy in Wisconsin, growing renewable source of energy. And so right now we don't have a ton. One of the points we wanted to make in our report was that even if we scale it up to the point where we need to get to for various projections for being carbon free in Wisconsin by 2050, you know, the state has their clean energy plan where they say we need this much solar. You know, we were involved with a study that did a kind of a roadmap as well. But even if we can get even if we get all the solar we need to reach our carbon-free goals, we're going to need on the order of maybe 300,000 acres of solar panels to generate all the electricity that we need for solar to play its role in getting us carbon-free electricity. And so, you know, 300,000 acres, that's only a fraction of our total ag land. And when you're talking about the million acres that we're already using to primarily harvest energy in the form of corn for solar, you know, this is less than a third of that. So just for comparison.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to As Goes Wisconsin. Our guests are Climate, Energy, and Air Program Director Chelsea Handler and Science Program Director Paul Mathewson, who are here from Clean Wisconsin.
So with that, then, talking about the report, because the report pretty much said it is more energy efficient to swap some of the cornfield land for solar panels, considering all of the different inputs that go into doing both, some being for the corn, you obviously have to clear land, you have to grow it, all the resources that go into actually harvesting. But then also, obviously, with solar panels, it's the materials themselves, it's the putting them in. And so knowing that, if there was the political will to actually make some of those changes, who would have to be involved and how would the state go about trying to swap out some of that land?
Yeah, I think I can take that one. So when there's a large utility scale proposed solar project, basically a developer has to come in with an application for construction to the Public Service Commission. That's an agency, kind of a regulatory body in the state of Wisconsin that oversees this kind of new construction. So they have to apply at the Public Service Commission. There's a really detailed process where they submit a lot of information and data about the project. There's extensive public comment opportunities, so folks in communities can engage. Developers are usually talking with folks in the communities, and they basically have to secure leases with landowners who are going to host those panels on their land. So that's, you know, a lot of farmers and other landowners in the area. They basically have a process where they're kind of optimizing a project and then securing all those leases where the farmers will get, you know, payments each year for functionally, you know, renting out their land to grow a new type of crop, which is solar instead of, you know, if it was corn for ethanol or whatever else they were growing on the land before. So it goes through this extensive process. There are, you know, various interveners. Clean Wisconsin often intervenes in these cases. And then the commissioners at the Public Service Commission ultimately decide on the project and can approve it and have it go forward. So a lot of these projects are really led by developers. They'll sometimes then basically have that energy the electricity from the solar panels go to utilities. A lot of our major utilities in Wisconsin have their own carbon goals and want to get to net zero emissions by 2050. So it's really in their best interest too. So in many ways, the state and utilities and developers and you know, local landowners and farmers are working collaboratively in this effort to bring more solar to Wisconsin.
So one of the things you just said, Chelsea, that was interesting. So it is considered swap, like, even though solar obviously is not a crop, it is not something that you plant, for farmers, it is considered growing a new crop?
I think that's a really useful way to think about it. I've heard people talk about it as a different crop rotation, where you're doing that with the land for, you know, 20 or 30 years. And then when the useful lifetime of the solar panels is, you know, completed, then you can put something else in it. In the meantime, you've got more deep-rooted plants besides corn, you know, native grasses, for example, that are storing more carbon in the soil, that are helping to heal the soil after kind of repeated plantings of annual crops, that can start to deplete some of the nutrients. You're providing pollinator habitat. So it is a nice way to kind of rotate and rest the land by growing a different crop. You know, I think that there's a little bit of a myth that solar is not compatible with ag land and that it's not the right place for it. But I think that that's, you know, not totally true. I think that it can really be a complement. I think it can be part of the suite of what we grow on our land. And it's also just not true that all of our ag land right now is being used for food production. Mm-hmm. As this study demonstrates, you know, a full quarter of the 4 million acres of corn that are grown in Wisconsin right now are already being used to grow energy. And they're doing it in a much less efficient way. You know, by putting solar on that land, we can basically produce 100 times more energy than we could from the corn ethanol. So it's not at odds with feeding ourselves. We already grow food or grow crops for food, for fiber, for energy. And this is just one piece of the puzzle.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to keep you both through the break. Maybe talk a little bit more about either obstacles and objections to making this happen. Our guests are from Clean Wisconsin, Chelsea Chandler, who's the Climate, Energy, and Air Program Director, and Paul Mathewson, who is the Science Program Director. Stick with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Madnair. And we are talking to Climate, Energy, and Air Program Director Chelsea Chandler and Science Program Director Paul Mathewson, both from Clean Wisconsin, about the new report that they put out in January, Corn Ethanol versus Solar Land Use Comparison, which basically found that solar panels and solar farms are a lot more efficient and produce a lot more energy. Basically, you get a bigger bang for your buck versus cornfields for ethanol. And Jane, you said we got a text over the break?
We do have a text from the 541. Is there non-farmable land suitable for solar farms that don't take away from the food farmable land? And in the event a farmer swaps out corn for solar, how much gross income can they lose or gain?
I'll maybe take that first part of the question. There are a lot of different places where we can put solar panels, including on rooftops, you know, of your homes, your businesses, and that is a great place to put them. And we need a lot more rooftop solar as well. But the fact of the matter is we also need these large-scale projects if we have any chance of getting to our climate goals and kind of creating a safer future for our kids. We were involved in an analysis last year that showed we need about 31 gigawatts of solar by 2050 from these large-scale projects. That's, you know, on the order of 3 to 4 large utility-scale projects per year. There's a number of reasons why we site projects in a certain location. They have to be close to the appropriate kind of transmission to be able to link into the grid. So that's important, having kind of dry, flat land. So there are reasons why some of the our rural lands are being used for these solar farms. But you know, I think there is, as I was saying before, a bit of a myth that we're actually taking away from our food production when we're siting solar in these rural areas, because a lot of what we're doing right now is producing energy on our agricultural lands in a much more inefficient way than we could be if we had more solar farms. In fact, we could free up a lot of land for additional food production if we were to switch from more corn ethanol to solar energy.
Yeah, that was, as I noted earlier, you know, for all the solar that we need for our 2050 goals, this is less than 3% of the ag land in the state. And so, you know, can we find the most marginal land, you know, the least productive land in the state that maybe not great for, you know, for harvesting corn right now? Can we put solar on that instead and then kind of shift things around? So we're growing corn where it should be grown and then putting solar where, you know, it's not great and you're contributing to water quality issues. You know, there's the nitrate, you know, there's health problem all around the state where corn is grown. It's not, we're not taking half the land out of production here. We're talking a small percentage. And can we do it in a way to maximize keeping our best land in production, in crop production, and, you know, siting the solar, you know, where it makes sense to in a responsible way to, you know, to replace where we're having agricultural, disproportionate agricultural issues. And then I can also talk to the second question on that text about the economics of it. You know, this is something we've tried to dig into a little bit. It's hard because the terms of leases between the landowners and the solar developers, you know, that's not public information. So, you know, there's no real good information, solid information about, you know, what kind of lease value they're getting from a solar versus what they get on from continuing to harvest corn or whatnot on the land. But from the information that's available is that, you know, they are getting on the low end of solar, of the information about solar leases, the low end of what the developers are offering farmers is on the high end at best of what they would get on, you know, a typical, on a good year of growing corn. And then obviously corn, that fluctuates, you know, what are the costs of inputs that year? Is fertilizer costs high? See, you know, what can they sell the corn for? So it's a lot more variable in terms of the income you get with growing a crop, whereas solar, that's a steady income, you know, you're getting that every year. And like I said, the information that's available, solar leases are typically higher than they are for growing a crop. And then just, you know, it's also, it seems like it's a good option for, you know, a farmer who might be, you know, getting to retirement age and still wants to make money off the land and doesn't want to sell to developer, because once it's developed to residential development, it's gone forever. Whereas a solar, after the useful life, the land is still there. It's probably even healthier, having rested for a while. So, you know, we also like to point out, you know, a lot of ag lands being, you know, sold off and permanently converted into residential development. And so this isn't the only way that, you know, farmland is being impacted in the state.
Yeah, I think a lot of farmers are seeing this as a great opportunity for more kind of steady, reliable, longer-term income, and that is really a smart financial decision for their businesses, and it's something that's really helping to kind of secure the legacy of their farm, to help with farm succession and passing it on to the next generation. And we know that farm succession and access are real challenges right now. I can say there are a lot of landowners that are really enthusiastic about this, all the ones that have already signed leases for the solar projects we have. And I think there are a number of people that are clamoring for this too. Just since we've released this study, we've received a number of emails from people saying, I read about this study. How do I sign up? How do I get solar on my land?
Great.
I just got one more email like that this morning. So I think there is, you know, a group of people who really are enthusiastic and see the economic potential and the stability that solar can bring to their farms.
Well, with the minute that we have left, is there anywhere anyone in the audience who's listening who would like to get more information or any way that they could get involved, where they should go?
Yeah, I'd just refer you over to our website at cleanwisconsin.org. Otherwise, we're on Facebook and Instagram as well. And so you can find our Clean Wisconsin handle there. But we regularly post updates about the work that we're doing, any new reports like this solar versus ethanol study we put out, and ways that you can get involved. We send out action alerts so you can help support some of these large-scale solar projects, too, that are coming up this year.
Absolutely. Well, this is so fascinating, especially what you were saying as far as the way to preserve the farmland versus it transferring. And so Chelsea Chandler, Paul Mathewson, thank you so much for spending time with us today. This is super fascinating. We will link all the report and all the social and website for Clean Wisconsin in our show notes today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us. This was fun.
All right. When we come back, Tanya Atkinson and Dr. Megan Schaefer will be here to talk about vasectomies. Great. Can't wait. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Well, I went to see my doctor. I said, Doc, I can't pay my bills. The rent's all spent, the truck's got a dent, and I think I'm getting the chills from being forced to sleep alone. You see, this house just ain't no home. I can't afford no kids, my life is on the skids, 'cause my woman says, leave me alone. Unless you get a vasectomy, you ought to get a vasectomy. Just one little
Who sings that song, Jane?
This is by the Limelighters.
The Limelighters.
Yes.
Always topical. Always just really on it with the music, Jane. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Madinaire. And our next guests both work for Planned Parenthood Wisconsin. We are joined by urologist Dr. Megan Schaefer and president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Wisconsin, Tanya Atkinson. And we're going to talk about vasectomies, because mid-February, right? It was around February, the middle of February, Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin decided to start offering vasectomies as a service because there's been a huge increase in men who want a vasectomy. And, it just happens to correspond with the overturn of Roe v. Wade.
So interesting.
But we thought it would be good just to, for men who are maybe on the fence, who they've thought about it, or maybe they're super scared of it, talk about what the procedure is, maybe debunk some of the myths, and then give more information about other things that Planned Parenthood still is open and in serving lots of patients and all the care that they're providing. So welcome to the show, ladies.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Yeah, excited to be here.
So I guess let's just start maybe with the decision to do it. And I don't know if, Tanya, this is a question for you as far as, I guess I was kind of surprised that this wasn't something, that this was a new service, and that in the range of reproductive care that, because I understand it to be fairly simple. And so what was the changing point as far as understanding, like, oh, this is something that there's a demand for and we should start offering?
Yeah. And Dr. Schaefer can fill in more. So Planned Parenthood Wisconsin, in partnership with the Medical College, have been looking at adding this service for some time. And then when Roe was overturned, the demand totally spiked. And so Dr. Schaefer and others who had been on a path to adding it recognize that now is the time to really accelerate getting that service online. But I'll defer Dr. Schaefer, who has more details.
Yeah, I mean, we as a department, so I work at the Medical College of Wisconsin in the Department of Urology, and it's something that we had talked about for years just in terms of a great way to engage with the community here in Milwaukee. I think a lot of the reason why people go into medicine to begin with is to not only provide services to patients in sort of traditional spaces, your clinics, et cetera, but to find a way to impact your community as well. So we have been talking for a long time about how do we get these services out into the community, and Planned Parenthood was obviously at the top of the list of how we do that. And then when the decision leaked, it was last spring.
It was May.
May, I think it was. When the decision leaked, I mean, it just sort of lit a fire in the sense of, okay, I mean, if we're ever going to be doing this, now is really the time to be doing this. You know, patients need better access to all forms of contraceptive care. And so I got in touch at that time with Dr. Allison Linton, who is also an MCW physician, but spends a lot of time at Planned Parenthood on the OBGYN side of things, and said, okay, how do we do this? And however many months later, in February, we did our inaugural SNP.
I feel like the inaugural SNP is a little bit different than earning your first dollar and getting that framed.
Jeez, now I want to write a song about that, the inaugural SNP.
And so what has it been, you know, maybe not lines out the door, but has it been received as far as there's the demand is, that you found that the demand is there?
Yeah, the demand has been pretty overwhelming. So currently there's just two of us who are offering about a half day a month down there. And our slots are full for weeks out.
Wow.
So we're onboarding another physician here. And then we have another physician who's joining our group come this summer. So the start of the next academic year. And so we're hoping by the summer to be offering a half day per week.
That would be, yeah. And that would be great. And so as far as, because I feel like from the female point of view, the assumption is, or what you hear is, vasectomies are easier than getting your tubes tied. It's reversible. And so, like, what are some of the either truths or misconceptions that you hear the most about vasectomies?
Yeah, I think so. I think it is true from a purely medical standpoint. A vasectomy is a much less invasive procedure in the sense that to perform a vasectomy, you just have to go through the scrotal skin. The contents of the scrotum are not in, they're very external. They're pretty, they're right out there, you know. For a woman to have her tubes tied, you have to go into her abdominal cavity, and there's just a lot more, you know, high-end real estate in there, a lot more things that can go wrong, a lot more complications that you can run into just being in a space that's a lot more, you know, protected. But I do always tell patients, you know, again, from my standpoint, this is a very straightforward, very minimally invasive procedure. But from your standpoint, this is obviously maximally invasive. Yeah. Someone's, you know, rooting around down there, putting a hole down there. It's a very sensitive area. But from just a strictly anatomic standpoint, there's not too much trouble you can get in the scrotum. So we can do it in the office under local anesthesia. You know, patients don't need a general anesthetic, and the potential risks of complications are overall minimal and relatively minor when you compare them to the potential complications from something like a tubal.
And so that's really good to know. But then also, like, is it actually reversible? Because I feel like I hear that a lot, but then sometimes I see something that's like, well, not always.
Yeah, so there are procedures to reverse vasectomies, but when I counsel patients when they come in for their consultation, it's not an on-off switch. So if you're going to have a vasectomy, consider it a permanent procedure. Okay. The reason being, you know, reversal procedures should be done by people who have received sort of extra training on top of their urologic training to perform reversals. We typically use a surgical microscope to perform them. So it's a pretty skilled procedure to do. And depending on who does it and how far out you are from your vasectomy, the failure rates can be variable. I mean, if you had your vasectomy within the last 10 years and you go to someone who's very high volume and does a lot of them, they can have high success rates. I won't quote anyone's success rate because it's pretty individualized to the surgeon. But the other part of it is that they're typically not covered by insurance at all. So the total out-of-cost pocket to a patient is usually about a five-figure sum. So it's not the kind of thing where you can just kind of roll in and have it reversed and have that be sort of inconsequential.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
It's not covered by insurance at all?
There's a lot of reproductive care here in Wisconsin that doesn't get all that well covered by insurance.
That's a big sigh. That is interesting to know. We are talking to President and CEO of Planned Parenthood, Tanya Atkinson, and Dr. Megan Schaefer, who is a urologist at the medical college. And so with that, I guess I'm also interested as far as any demographic data, obviously knowing, I mean, maybe you don't have it, but as far as in this increased popularity of people, kind of more men taking responsibility for their role in family planning, reproductive health, is it mostly married men? Is there more young men as far as like not married and still have a very single life ahead of them? Or is there any kind of demographic data or trends that you've seen?
Yeah, definitely. And I don't have actual good data to quote for you, but I can tell you anecdotally from within my practice. I mean, the majority of people that you do see for this procedure are people who have kids and have made a joint decision with their partner that they're done having children. But you also certainly, and this reflects a lot of trends just in our world currently, not even just in our country, but in our world currently, where a lot of people are electing not to have children, right? And so you also have a lot of couples come in who say, you know, we know that having children is never going to be something that we want to do. And if we did decide we wanted to do it, there are other avenues to explore to becoming a parent. So I think overall, there's been a steady increase in people like that. I do think the decision has sort of, again, hastened everyone's sort of journey to our door. Mm-hmm. But that being said, you also have, I mean, I have patients from all walks of life who maybe are non-binary and who have all different sorts of partners, and they just never want to be in a situation where they, you know, could compromise a partner, and they are coming in for themselves, but also sort of to be protective of their partners.
I have to say, I do take some hope from this, because it just seems that since the overturn of Roe, all of the measures are extremely punitive towards women. And the other half of this equation is so rarely even mentioned. So it's lovely to see men stepping up and, as Kristen said, taking an active role in their responsibility for their partner's sexual health and their relationship's health.
Definitely.
And so with that, Tanya, we'll go back to you. What are some in the range of services that Planned Parenthood offers? Because as sometimes talking about misconceptions, people think that Planned Parenthood only provided abortions, which is couldn't be further from the truth. There is a whole range of services that you provide for health, reproductive health. Is there other services specific to men, cis men, that Planned Parenthood does? Or is this the main one now offering vasectomies?
That's an excellent question. Planned Parenthood Wisconsin for, you know, a very long time has provided services to both cis men and people assigned male at birth. And that's a population that we continue to see increasing. So we provide STD testing and treatment, wellness checks. We provide, condoms and education and testicular cancer screening as indicated. If there's a reason that the provider thinks that they need to move forward and do a cancer check. And then in addition, we have other, other educational services. We got a lot of young men who are engaged with our education program. So there is a range of services that are provided for men.
And so as far as kind of just furthering, I know these answers, but as far as opportunity to talk more about what are kind of the range of services, how Planned Parenthood is doing in the last 6, 7, 8 months, how far are we away from since Roe got overturned? As far, because I know at one point I remember going to one of the rallies, I think it was in Red Arrow Park, where it was said that not only is Planned Parenthood not going away, you guys were hiring and growing even after June. Yeah. And so what's the kind of status update in general of Planned Parenthood Wisconsin?
Well, thank you. That's an excellent question. We are still hiring.
Great.
So if anybody, still check out the website, ppwi.org is the website. So thank you for that question. Planned Parenthood Wisconsin provides a very large range of reproductive health care services. And, I won't go into all of them. I really do encourage folks to check out the website. It does have the full the full range of services. Obviously we do, I'll just sort of do them in categories. We obviously do the family planning, and have a large variety of contraceptives available depending on the individual. Planned Parenthood Wisconsin also has a quarterly contraceptive kit. So to reduce travel barriers in particular, or other reasons that people aren't able to physically come into a center, people can get their contraceptive method delivered right to their home quarterly. So that's another service. There's a lot of cancer prevention and intervention work that's done at Planned Parenthood Wisconsin. So HPV vaccinations, breast and cervical cancer screenings. There's a range of biopsies that are offered, as well as colposcopy, which is the next step after if something seems abnormal with the Pap. And then as well as LEAP. And LEAP we also do in partnership with the Medical College in Frater. And we're adding LEAP at the Water Street Health Center as well. And then finally, gender-affirming hormone therapy is a service that's been added in, it was added in the middle of COVID. And so that's a service that folks can access via telehealth. And many of the services that Planned Parenthood Wisconsin offers can be offered in part or, depending on the service, in whole via telehealth.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to keep you through the break because we'd love to talk more about this. But I also want to talk a bit about the separate entity that is Planned Parenthood Wisconsin and Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin. So we'll talk about that a little bit more when we come back. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jay Matinair. And we are talking to President and CEO of Planned Parenthood Wisconsin, Tanya Atkinson, and urologist Dr. Megan Schaefer. We started talking about vasectomies and debunking some of the myths about them now that they are a service that is offered through Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, and some of the other medical and healthcare services that Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin offers. But sometimes I think people get confused that there are two separate entities. There is Planned Parenthood Wisconsin, that is the health provider that gives services. And then there is Planned Parenthood Advocates, which is the activism policy side. And they're separate, right, Tanya?
Yes, they are very separate organizations, and thank you for pointing out that separation. So Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, the healthcare provider, educator, is the entity that's partnering with the Medical College of Wisconsin exclusively. Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin is a totally separate entity, and they are the organization that does advocacy, outreach, organizing, and civic engagement work.
But you're president and CEO of both of them, right?
I am president of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Wisconsin, and it's just lots of
Do you have to physically, is there physically two different hats that you have to take one off and then put the other one on? It's like, which brain am I thinking with right now?
It's that hat that's got the two bills, you know, one on one side, one on the other, can throw it around. So
with the advocacy side, what is happening in, obviously, a lot of involvement in the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, I would imagine. I think I heard we got wind of some rallies that are coming up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of civic engagement going on around the Supreme Court elections, reminding people that there is an election. As we know, it's a low turnout. It's a low turnout race. And really, engaging folks that are, excited to get out there and talk to their community, their fellow community members about the importance of the race, connecting dots. I mean, we've seen what a Supreme Court can do at the national level, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court will have similar powers much more locally. So there are there's a lot of rallies going on between now and April 1st that Advocates is doing, and really elevating the importance of this election. The reality is that the outcome of this election will impact Wisconsin for generations to come.
Yeah. Not an understatement there.
No, it certainly isn't. I do have one medical-related question again, probably a little bit more for Megan. From a male perspective, if I was going to get a vasectomy, I think one of the first questions I would ask is, when are things going to be up and running?
It's a very good question. So first and foremost, I think it's also good to debunk. So when we do a vasectomy, all we're doing is removing sperm from the ejaculate. We're not impacting testosterone production, libido, anything else to do with sexual function. That being said, the vas deferens is a very long tube. So from where we cut downstream, men have on average about 3 months worth of ejaculations that will still have viable sperm in them. So when you can get back up and running is what I say is no sexual activity for a week. So you can get yourself back up and running after a week, but you do need to use another form of contraception for 3 months after the procedure. And then we do always say we have to check a semen analysis. There are situations in which your body does miraculous things and will heal those two little tubes back together. So we have to check semen analysis, make sure you're actually good to go. And then that we do it about 3 months.
Thank you.
The miraculous body that heals itself.
Sneaky,
oh, that would be
sneaky.
That's like that. I don't know if that's worse or when your birth, that has to be worse than when your birth control fails, like your
it's
pill.
Very inconvenient. Yeah.
So just as a reminder, cause I do want to make sure when services for vasectomies are available, because it is only, you said it's only once a month right now?
We're down there twice a month.
Twice a month,
now.
Sorry.
Yep. So I think Pete's down there on a Tuesday. I'm down there, I think, the third Thursday. But hopefully weekly coming in the next few months.
That would be great. And people can sign up for that through the website?
Yep.
Yes. People can sign up for the vasectomy services and any of the other services online at ppwi.org.
Perfect. And then as a reminder for all of the health services in general that is available, they're all open. And so how many different locations are there, Tanya, across Wisconsin?
22 health centers across the state of Wisconsin, and then also via telehealth. So if you look at a scatter map of people who are served across the state, I'm from a real small town myself, so some of the smallest towns, you can see patients on scatter maps, and then, of course, to some of the largest cities, too.
Where are you from?
I'm from Boscobel. It's southwest Wisconsin. A little shout out to the Driftless region, if anybody's
there. You go, Boscobel.
There, so,
you know what the name Boscobel reminds me of? The little tiny cheese wheels. What are those called?
I have no.
The little babble.
Yep, babble. Yeah, something like Bondu up. No, that's a town.
No, but that's. I think that's so good to, because I know for a while, people don't always know that there's 22. There's probably one closer to you and your area, because this show airs across the state. So as far as knowing that there is a health service location closer to you than maybe you think is important to know. And so anything else you'd like our audience to know, either of you, before we let you go and get on with your day?
I would just remind people that there's an election on April 4th and encourage people to really get out and exercise their right to vote.
Absolutely. Oh, doctor, I think you're muted.
Vasectomies are safe and effective, and if you are looking for vasectomy services, check out Planned Parenthood Wisconsin.
There you go. Well, this was informative and fun.
Yes.
Tanya, Megan, thank you so much for joining us today. We will link all of this information on our show notes for today. But thank you for the work that you do, and thanks for joining us.
Great. Thanks. Thank you all so much.
Thanks all right. Yeah, of course. All right. Well, that will do it for us this noon hour on Tuesday. When we come back, I'm very excited because my dear friend Heidi Dalibor is going to be here to talk about not only the only co-op brewery in the state.
Okay, that's impressive.
New Barons. So we'll hear a little bit about what that means as far as what it means to be a co-op member owner brewery. But also, she is the CEO as a woman. And they are doing a ton of fun things for Women's History Month.
Great.
Tomorrow is International Women's Day. They're working with our friends over at Third Space for the...
love them.
For the IPA, what's it called? Drink Like a Girl? No. Run something like a girl.
We'll have it when we come back.
We'll have it. We're going to look it up. But for now, we're going to go to the top of our news. Stick with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin.